the like. And when centralization collapses on itself, as it inevitably does, back we go to the family farm. The Roman Empire grew fat on the fruits of huge, corporate, slave-driven agricultural operations to the near exclusion of any small farms by the end of the era. But when Rome crashed and burned, its urbanized citizenry scurried out to every nook and cranny of Italy's mountains and valleys, returning once again to the work of feeding themselves and their families. They're still doing it, famously, to this day. Where our modern dependence on corporate agriculture is concerned, some signs suggest we might play out our hand a little smarter than Rome did. Industrialized Europe has lately developed suspicions of the centralized food supply, precipitated by mad cow disease and genetically modified foods. The European Union, through government agencies and enforceable laws, is now working to preserve its farmlands, its local food economies, and the authenticity and survival of its culinary specialties. Here in the United States, we are still, statistically speaking, in the thrall of drive-through dining, but we're not unaware that things have gone wrong with our food and the culture of its production. Sociologists write about the disappearing middle, referring to both middle America and mid-sized operators. Whole communities in the heartland left alarmingly empty after a decades-old trend toward fewer, bigger commodity farms. We are quicker to address our problems with regional rather than national solutions. Local agencies throughout the Midwest are devising their own answers, mandating the purchase of locally grown organic food in schools, jails, and other public facilities. Policies in many states aim to bring younger people to farming, a profession whose average age is currently about 55. About 15% of U.S. farms are now run by women, up from 5% in 1978. The booming organic and market garden industries suggest that consumers are capable of defying a behemoth industry and embracing change. The direct sales farming sector is growing. Underneath our stylish clothing, it seems we are still animals, retaining some vestigial desire to sniff around the waterhole and the food supply. In the forum of media and commerce, the notion of returning to the land is still reliably stereotyped as a harebrained hippie enterprise. But image probably doesn't matter much to people who wear coveralls to work and have power meetings with a tractor. In a nation pouring its resources into commodity agriculture, corn and soybeans everywhere and not a speck fit to eat, back to the land is an option with a permanent, quiet appeal. The popularity of gardening is evidence of this. So is the huge growth of U.S. agritourism, including U-Pick operations, subscription farming, and farm-based restaurants or bed and breakfasts. Many of us who aren't farmers or gardeners still have some element of farm nostalgia in our family past, real or imagined. A secret longing for some connection to a life where a rooster crows in the yard.
Homegrown by Stephen Hopp. Oh, sure, Barbara Kingsolver has 40 acres and a mule, a donkey, actually. But how can someone like me participate in the spirit of growing things when my apartment overlooks the freeway and other people's windows? Shall I raise a hog in my spare bedroom? How big is that spare bedroom? Just kidding. But even for people who live in urban areas, more than half our population, directly contributing to local food economies isn't out of the question. Container gardening on porches, balconies, back steps, or even a sunny window can yield a surprising amount of sprouts, herbs, and even produce. Just a few tomato plants in big flower pots can be surprisingly productive. If you have any yard at all, part of it can become a garden. You can spade up the sunniest part of it for seasonal vegetables, or go for the more understated option of using perennial edibles in your landscaping. Fruit, nut, citrus, or berry plants come in many attractive forms, with appropriate choices for every region of the country. If you're not a landowner, you can still find in most urban areas some opportunity to garden. Many community-supported agriculture, or CSA, operations allow or even require subscribers to participate on their farms. They might even offer a work-for-food arrangement. Most urban areas also host community gardens, using various organizational protocols, a widespread practice in European cities that has taken root here. Some rent garden spaces to the first comers. Others provide free space for neighborhood residents. Some are organized and run by volunteers for some specific goal, such as supplying food to a local school, while others accommodate special needs of disabled participants or at-risk youth. Information and locations can be found at the American Community Garden Association site, communitygarden.org.
In summer, a young rooster's fancy turns to, how can I say this delicately, the most ham-fisted attempts at courtship I've ever had to watch. And yes, I'm including high school. As predicted, half of Lily's chick crop was growing up to be male. This was dawning on everyone as the boys began to venture into mating experiments, climbing aboard the ladies sometimes backwards or perfectly sideways. The young hens shrugged them off and went on looking for bugs in the grass. But the three older hens, mature birds we'd had around a while, did not suffer fools gladly. Emmy, an elderly Jersey giant, behaved as any sensible grandmother would if a teenager approached her looking for action. She bit him on the head and chased him into a boxwood bush. These boys had much to learn, and not just the art of love. A mature, skillful rooster takes his job seriously as protector of the flock, using different vocal calls to alert his hens to food, aerial predators, or dangers on the ground. He leads his wives into the coop every evening at dusk. Lacking a proper coop, he'll coax them up onto a tree branch or other safe nighttime roost. Hence his name. The feminist in me balks to admit it, but a flock of free-range hens behaves very differently without a rooster. Scattered, vulnerable, a witless wandering of lost souls. Of course, they're chickens. They have bird brains, evolved in polygamous flocks, and have lived for millennia with humans who rewarded docility and egg production. Modern hens of the sturdiest breeds can crank out an egg a day for months at a stretch until winter days grow too short. And that they can do with no need for a fella. Large-scale egg operations keep artificial lights on their hens to extend the laying period, and they don't keep roosters at all. The standard white grocery store egg is sterile. But in a barnyard, where chickens forage and risk predation, flock behavior is more interesting when a guy is ruling the roost. So Lily wanted one rooster for flock protection and the chance to watch her hens hatch chicks next year. The position was open for a good rooster, not a bad one. Over the years, we've had both. Our historic favorite was Mr. Doodle. If a professional circuit had been open to him, as dogs have their sheep-herding trials and such, we could have retired Mr. Doodle for stud. He had a keen eye for hen safety and a heart for justice. I saved caterpillars I pulled off my garden so I could throw them into the chicken yard and watch Mr. Doodle run to snatch up each one, cock his head in judgment, and dole one out to each of six hens in turn before he started the next round. Any number of caterpillars not evenly divisible by six would set him into angst. He hated to play favorites. But that was the ideal husband. The guys we had now were no second date. They're still young, we allowed. Even a dreamboat has to start somewhere, getting chased into the boxwood a time or two before finding his inner gentleman. We'd be watching our boys closely now as they played a real game of Survivor. All but one would end up on our table, and we couldn't get soft-hearted. Keeping multiple roosters is no kindness. They inevitably engage in a well-known sport that's illegal in 48 states. Who would get to stay? The criteria are strict and varied. Good alarm calls, unselfish instincts for foraging and roosting, and a decent demeanor toward humans. Sometimes an otherwise fine rooster will start attacking kids, a capital crime in our barnyard. And finally, our winner would need a good singing voice. We'd be hearing his particular cockadoodle for more than 1,000 mornings. Chanticleers, as the storybooks call them, are as diversely skilled as opera singers. We wanted a Pavarotti. Crowing skills are mostly genetic, arriving with developing male hormones. So far, we'd heard nothing resembling a crow. And then, one morning, we did. It was in July, soon after my summertime ritual of moving our bedroom outside onto the screen sleeping porch. The summer nights are balmy and marvelous, though it's hard to sleep with so much going on after dark. Crickets, katydids, and fireflies fill every visible and aural space. Screech owls send out their love calls. Deer sometimes startle us at close range with the strange nasal whiffle of their alarm call. And in the early hours of one morning, as I watched the forested hillside color itself in slow motion from gray to green, I heard what I thought must be a new Virginian species of frog. Croak! I woke Stephen, as wives wake husbands everywhere, to ask, "What's that sound?" I knew he wouldn't be annoyed, because this was no tedious burglary suspect. It was wildlife. He sat up, attentive. His research interest is bioacoustics, birdsong, and other animal communication. He can identify any bird native to the eastern United States by ear and can nail most insects, mammals, and amphibians at least a category. Like most mortals, I cannot. I can mistake mammal calls for birds and certain insects for power tools. He offered a professional opinion on this pre-dawn croak. I don't know. As we listened, it became clear that two of them were having some kind of contest. Croak. A pause for formulation of the response. Crickle, eek. Stephen figured it out way ahead of me. These were our boys of summer. Yikes. More rooster voices joined the choir as dawn crept over the ridge. Eventually, one emerged as something of a leader, to which the others responded together in the call-and-response style of an old-time religious revival.
Ork! Krigalik! Croak! Curdle!
We had on our hands what sounded like a newly opened Burlitz School for Rooster, with a teacher hired on a tight budget. The girls heard us from downstairs and came up to the sleeping porch to see what was so funny. Soon we were all flopped across the bed laughing after every chorus. Welcome to our funny farm. Did I say we were hoping for a Pavarotti? We had a gang of tone-deaf idol wannabes. For how many weeks would this harrowing audition go on before we could narrow the field of applicants? One outstanding contestant punctuated the end of his croak every time with a sort of burp.
Kr-ar-blup.
This guy had a future in the culinary arts. Mine. Our turkeys were looking gorgeous after their awkward adolescent molt into adult plumage. Bourbon reds are as handsome as it gets on the turkey runway, with chestnut red bodies, white wings, and white-tipped tail feathers. The boys weren't crowing, of course, but this would be their only failing in the department of testosterone. We'd seen that show before. Prior to our move to Virginia, I'd raised a few Bourbon Reds as a trial run to see how we liked the breed before attempting to found a breeding flock. I'd gotten 5 poults and worried from day one about how I would ever reconcile their darling fuzzy heads with the season of Thanksgiving. But that summer, with the dawning of adolescent hormones, the cuteness problem had resolved itself, and how. 4 of my 5 birds turned out to be male. They forgot all about me, their former mom, and embarked on a months-long poultry frat party. Picture the classic turkey display in which the male turkey spreads his colorful tail feathers in an impressive fan. Now picture that times four, continuing nonstop, month after month. The lone female spent the summer probably wishing she'd been born with the type of eyes that can roll. These guys meant to impress her or die trying. They shimmied their wing feathers with a sound like rustling taffeta, stretched their necks high in the air, and belted out a croaky gobble, over and over and over. Our nearest neighbor down the road had called to ask tentatively, I don't mean to be nosy, but is your rooster sick? Many of us were relieved that year at harvest time when our first turkey experiment reached its conclusion. By autumn, the boys had begun to terrify Lily, who was six that year, by rushing at her gobbling when she entered the poultry yard to feed her chickens. In the beginning, she'd lobbied to name the turkeys, which I nixed, but I relented later when I saw what she had in mind. She christened them Mr. Thanksgiving, Mr. Dinner, Mr. Sausage, and in a wild first-grade culinary stretch, sushi. So we knew what we were in for now as our new flock came of age. By midsummer, all our April-born poultry were well settled in. Our poultry house is a century-old tin-roofed grain barn with wire-screened sides covered by a lattice of weathered wood slats. We had remodeled the building by dividing it into two large rooms, separate nighttime roosting coops for chickens and turkeys. They don't cohabit well. Secure from predatory raccoons, possums, coyotes, owls, and large snakes. An entry room at the front of the building with doors into both the coops we used for storing grain and supplies. The chicken coop had a whole wall of laying boxes. Lily had high hopes. And a back door that opened directly to the outdoors. The chickens now ranged freely all over our yard during the day and only had to be shut in at night. The turkey side had a hatch opening to a large, wire-enclosed outdoor run. The turkey poults had recently figured out how to fly out through this hatch and were enjoying the summer days, returning to the indoor coop only to roost at night. Although most people think of chickens and turkeys as grain eaters, and for CAFO birds, grain is the best of what they eat, they consume a lot of grass and leaves when they're allowed to forage. Both chickens and turkeys are also eager carnivores. I've seen many a small life meet its doom at the end of a beak in our yard, not just beetles and worms, but salamanders and wild-eyed frogs. The so-called free-range vegetarian hen's testimony on an egg carton label is perjury unless someone's trained them with little shock collars. Our Bourbon Reds were skilled foragers, much larger than the chickens now, but a bit slower to mature sexually. It wasn't yet clear how our dozen birds would sort themselves out in that regard. Frankly, I was hoping for girls. My kids find this hard to believe, but when I was a child, I'd never heard of zucchini. We knew of only one kind of summer squash, the yellow crooknecks we grew copiously in our garden. They probably also carried those down at the IGA in summertime, if any unfortunate and friendless soul actually had to buy them. We had three varieties of hard-shelled winter squash, butternuts, pumpkins, and a green-striped giant peculiar to our region called the Kushaw, which can weigh as much as a third grader. We always kept one of these on the cool attic stairs all winter, Kushaw, not third grader, and sawed off a piece every so often for our winter orange vegetable intake. They make delicious pies, and that is the full squash story of my tender youth. Most people might think that was enough. Not my dad. Always on the lookout for adventure, he went poking into the new Kroger that opened in a town not far from ours when I was in my early teens. Oh, what a brave new world of culinary exotics! They carried actual whole cream pies down there, frozen alive in aluminum plates, and also vegetables of which we were previously unaware. Artichokes, for example. We kids voted for the pies, but got overruled. Dad brought home artichokes. Mom dutifully boiled and served them with forks, assuming one would eat the whole thing. We tried hard. I didn't touch another artichoke for 20 years. But our lives changed forever the day he brought home zucchinis. "It's Italian food," he explained. We weren't sure how to pronounce it. And while the artichokes had brought us to tears and throat lozenges, we liked these dark green dirigibles a lot. The next year, Dad discovered he could order the seeds and grow this foreign food right at home. I was in charge of the squash region of the garden in those days. My brother did the onions. And we were diligent children. I'm pretty sure the point source of the zucchini's introduction into North America was Nicholas County, Kentucky. If not, we did our part, giving them to friends and strangers alike. We ate them steamed, baked, batter-fried, in soup, in summer, and also in winter, because my mother developed a knockout zucchini onion relish recipe that she canned in jars by the score. I come from a proud line of folks who know how to deal with a squash. So July doesn't scare me. We picked our first baby yellow crooknecks at the beginning of the month, little beauties that looked like fancy restaurant fare when we sautéed them with the blossoms still attached. On July 6th, I picked two little patty pans, the white squash that looked like flying saucers, 4 yellow crooknecks, 6 golden zucchini, and 5 large costata romanescas, a zucchini relative with a beautifully firm texture and a penchant for attaining the size of a baseball bat overnight. I am my father's daughter, always game for the new seed catalog adventure, and I am still in charge of the squash region of the garden. I can overdo things, but wasn't ready to admit that yet. "I love all this squash," I declared, bringing the rainbow of their shapes and colors into the kitchen along with the season's first beans, purple romano and gold of bacau, mini white cucumbers, 5 color chard, and some Chioggia beets, an Italian heirloom that displays red and white rings like a target when sliced in cross-section. I was still cheerful 2 days later when I brought in the day's 19 squash. And then 33 more over the next week, including a hefty haul of cubit-long costatas. Unlike other squash, costatas are still delicious at this size, though daunting. We split and stuffed them with sautéed onions, breadcrumbs, and cheese, and baked them in our outdoor bread oven. All dinner guests were required to eat squash and then take some home in plastic sacks. We started considering dinner guest lists, in fact, with an eye toward those who did not have gardens. Our gardening friends knew enough to slam the door if they saw a heavy sack approaching. Camille gamely did her part. Before her sister's birthday, she adapted several different recipes into a genius invention, chocolate chip zucchini cookies. She made a batch of about 100, obliterating in the process several green hulks that had been looming in the kitchen. She passed the tray around to Lily's friends at the birthday party with a sly grin as they crowded around the kitchen table to watch Lily open her presents. 4th graders hate squash. We watched them chew. They asked for seconds. Ha! Camille dared them to guess the secret ingredient, slanting her eyes suggestively at the dark green blimps that remained, one of them cut in half, on the kitchen counter. Cinnamon? Oatmeal? Candy canes? We'll never tell. But after the wrapping paper had flown, with all dust settled and the 100 cookies eaten, we still had more of those dirigibles on the counter. Had we planted too many vines? Should we let the weeds take them early? Oh, constant squash, they never let you down. Early one Saturday morning, as I lay sleepless, I whispered to Stephen, "We need to get a hog."
"A hog?"
"For the squash." He knew I couldn't be serious. For one thing, hogs are intelligent enough to become unharvestable. Their eyes communicate an endearing sensibility that poultry eyes don't, even when you've raised them from the darling stage. We didn't need a pet pig. But we did need something to dispatch all this zucchini, some useful purpose for the pyramid of excess vegetable biomass that was taking over our lives. My family knows I'm congenitally incapable of wasting food. I was raised by frugal parents who themselves grew up in the Depression when starvation seemed a genuine possibility. I have now, as a grown-up, learned to buy new jeans when mine have patches on the patches, but I have not learned to throw perfectly good food in the garbage. Not even into the compost, unless it has truly gone bad. To me, it feels like throwing away a Rolex watch or something. I'm just guessing on that. Food was grown by the sweat of someone's brow. It started life as a seed or newborn and beat all the odds. It's intrinsically the most precious product in our lives from an animal point of view. But there sat this pile on the kitchen counter, with its relatives jammed into a basket in the mudroom, afloat between garden and kitchen, just waiting for word so they could come in here too, the boat zucchinis. Sometimes I just had to put down my knives and admire their extravagant success. Their hulking, elongated cleverness. Their heft. I tried balancing them on their heads, on their sides. Right here in the kitchen, we had the beginnings of our own vegetable Stonehenge. Okay, yes, I was losing it. I could not stay ahead of this race. If they got a little moldy, then I could compost them. And the really overgrown ones we were cracking open for the chickens to eat. That isn't waste. That's eggs and meat. A hog could really do that for us in spades. Could they design an automobile engine that runs on zucchini? It didn't help that other people were trying to give them to us. One day we came home from some errands to find a grocery sack of them hanging on our mailbox. The perpetrator, of course, was nowhere in sight. Wow, we all said. What a good idea. Garrison Keeler says July is the only time of year when country people lock our cars in the church parking lot, so people won't put squash on the front seat. I used to think that was a joke. I don't want to advertise the presence or absence of security measures in our neighborhood, except to say that in rural areas, generally speaking, people don't lock their doors all that much. The notion of a gated community is comprehensible to us only in terms of keeping the livestock out of the crops. It's a relaxed atmosphere in our little town. Plus, our neighbors keep an eye out and will, if asked, tell us the make and model of every vehicle that ever enters the lane to our farm. So the family was a bit surprised when I started double-checking the security of doors and gates any time we were all about to leave the premises. "Do I have to explain the obvious?" I asked impatiently. "Somebody might break in and put zucchini in our house." It was only July. I'd admit no more squash, but I was not ready to admit defeat.
The Spirit of Summer by Camille. It's a Saturday afternoon in mid-July, and our farm is overflowing with life. After each trip to the garden, we come down the hill bearing armloads of cucumbers, squash, and tomatoes. We are now also harvesting peppers, eggplants, onions, green beans, and chard. In a few hours, some friends will be coming over for supper, so my mom and I study our pile of fresh vegetables and begin to prepare. We'll start by making the cucumber soup, which will be served first and needs time to chill. 14 small cucumbers go into the blender, one after the other, transformed into bright green pureed freshness as they meet the whirling blades. Then we stir in the skim milk yogurt we made yesterday. Finally, we add fresh herbs to the cool, light mixture and wedge the bowl into the refrigerator between gigantic bags of zucchini. Now it's time for the bread baking. This is the man's job in our household. So Stephen gets out his various bags of flour and begins to work his magic. A cup of this and a tablespoon of that fly into the mixer until he's satisfied. Then the machine's bread hook folds it all together and it's left to rise. Later, our friends arrive, and Nancy, a true bread artisan, works with Stephen to roll out and shape some plump baguettes. Outdoors, a fire has been crackling for hours in the big stone bread oven we built this spring. Nancy has been eager to come over and help try it out. She and Stephen set the baguettes on floured pans and slide them into the oven, which has been cleared of coals. The temperature inside is nearly 700 degrees. Meanwhile, Mom and I are working on dessert, cherry sorbet. We picked the cherries from the tree that shades our front porch, teasing us by bearing the most fruit on its highest branches. Every summer, Stephen and I climb ladders we've set into the back of the pickup truck, strategically parked under the tree, while Mom says, "Stop, be careful," and then finally climbs up there with us. Even so, bushels of shiny black cherries will stay out of reach for everybody that doesn't have wings. The blue jays get their share, but we still brought in quite a haul this year. Mom pits the cherries, staining her hands the purplish-black color of pen ink, while I heat water and honey on the stove. We mix the fruit and syrup together and let the concoction chill so it will be ready to pour into our ice cream maker after supper. The baguettes don't take long to bake in the hot stone oven. After about 15 minutes, we take them out and cut them open. The smell is enough to make you give up on cooking a gourmet meal and just eat bread instead. We resist, however, slicing the whole loaves lengthwise and laying the baguettes open-faced on a pan. We stack them with grilled vegetables and cheese, starting with slices of mozzarella we made yesterday with the help of my little sister and our Italian grandmother. Next, we pile on slices of nicely browned yellow squash, patty pan squash, green peppers, eggplants, and onions that I've just taken off the grill. The final layer is fresh tomatoes with basil. We stick the pans under the broiler for a few minutes, then sit down to enjoy our meal. I feel like I've been cooking all day, but it's so worth it. The soup is amazing after its rest in the fridge. It's the perfect finish to a humid afternoon spent chopping vegetables or hovering over a hot grill. We savor every bite and then bring out the vegetable-loaded baguettes. The broiler has melted the cheese just right, so everything melds together into one extraordinary flavor. After we sit a while talking, it's time for cherry sorbet. The dessert is almost too purple to be real, and an ideal combination of sweet and sour. Everyone finishes smiling. This has been one of the best meals of my life, not only because it was so delicious, but because all this food came from plants we watched growing from tiny seeds to jungles. We witnessed the moment in the mozzarella's life that the milk turned into curds and whey. We saw the bread go from sandy-colored glop to crusty golden gorgeous. We had a relationship with this meal. The recipes for cucumber yogurt soup, grilled vegetable panini, and cherry sorbet can be found on our website. Also on the website is a recipe for disappearing zucchini orzo. Another very easy way to cook squash is to slice it lengthwise, toss in a bowl with olive oil, salt, thyme, and oregano, and slap it on a hot grill alongside burgers or chicken. Whole green beans are also wonderful grilled this way. A grill basket will keep them from leaping into the flames. And be sure not to overlook the zucchini chocolate chip cookie recipe, which has passed the 10-year-old test. Squash season meal plan. Sunday. Braised chicken with squash, corn, and cilantro. Monday, grilled vegetable panini served with green salad. Tuesday, sliced cold chicken, cooked Sunday, and zucchini orzo. Wednesday, grilled hamburgers with grilled green beans and squash. Thursday, egg-battered squash blossoms stuffed with cheese served with salad. Friday, pizza with grilled baby squash, eggplant, caramelized onions, and mozzarella. Saturday, lamb chops and bake-stuffed zucchini.
Chapter 13. Life in a Red State. August. I've kept a journal for most of the years I've been gardening. I'm a habitual scribbler, jotting down the triumphs and flops of each season that I always feel pretty sure I'd remember anyway, that the collective farm woman melons were surprisingly prissy, that the Dolly Partons produced such whopping tomatoes the plants fell over. Who could forget any of that? Me, as it turns out. Come winter when it's time to order seeds again, I always need to go back and check the record. The journal lying open beside my bed also offers a handy incentive at each day's end for making a few notes about the weather, seasonal shifts in bloom and fruiting times, big family events, the day's harvest, or just the minutiae that keep me entertained. The power inside the pea-sized brain of a hummingbird, for example, that repeatedly built her nest near our kitchen door. Despite her migrations across continents and the storms of life, her return date every spring was the same, give or take no more than 24 hours. Over years, trends like that show up. Another one is that however jaded I may have become, winter knocks down the hollow stem of my worldliness, and I'll start each summer again with expectations as simple as a child's. The first tomato of the season brings me to my knees. Its vital stats are recorded in my journal with the care of a birth announcement. It's an early girl, 4 ounces, June 16th, blessed event, we've waited so long. Over the next few weeks, I note the number, size, and quality of the different tomato varieties as they begin to come in. 2 green zebras, 4 gorgeous Jaune Flamme, 1 single half-pound Russian Black. I note that the latter wins our summer's first comparative taste test, a good balance of tart and sweet with strong spicy notes. I describe it in my journal the way an enophile takes notes on a new wine discovery. On the same day, I report that our neighbor wants to give away all her Russian blacks on the grounds they are, she says, too ugly to eat. I actually let her give me a couple. As supply rises, value depreciates. 3 weeks after the first tomato entry in my journal, I've dropped the blessed event language and am just putting them down for the count. 10 Romas today, 8 Celebrity, 30 Juliet. I continue keeping track so we'll know eventually which varieties performed best. But by early August, I've shifted from numbers to pounds. We bring in each day's harvest in plastic grocery sacks that we heave onto a butcher's scale in our kitchen, jotting down the number on a notepad before moving on to processing. At this point in the year, we had officially moved beyond hobby scale. My records would show, eventually, whether we were earning more than minimum wage, but for certain, we would answer the question that was largely the point of this exercise. What does it take, literally, to keep a family fed? Organizing the spring planting had been tricky. How many pumpkins does a family eat in a year? How many jars of pickles? My one area of confidence was tomatoes. We couldn't have too many. We loved them fresh, sliced, in soups and salads, as pasta sauces, chutneys, and salsa. I'd put in 50 plants. In July, all seemed to be going according to plan when we hauled in just over 50 pounds of tomatoes. In August, the figure jumped to 302 pounds. In the middle of that month, our neighbor came over while I was canning. I narrowed my eyes and asked her, "Did I let you give me some tomatoes a few weeks ago?" She laughed. She didn't want them back either. Just because we're overwhelmed doesn't mean we don't still love them, even after the first thrill wears off. I assure my kids of this when they point out a similar trend in their baby books. Dozens of photos of the first smile, first bath, first steps, followed by little evidence that years 2 and 3 occurred at all. Tomatoes, like children, never achieve the villainous status of squash. They're too good to wear out their welcome. And if they nearly do, our in-town friends are always happy to take them. Fresh garden tomatoes are so unbelievably tasty, they ruin us utterly and forever on the insipid imports available in the grocery. In defiance of my childhood training, I cannot clean my salad plate in a restaurant when it contains one of those anemic wedges that taste like slightly sour water with a mealy texture. I'm amazed those things keep moving through the market, but the world apparently has tomato eaters for whom kinda reddish is qualification enough. A taste for better stuff is cultivated only through experience. Drowning in good tomatoes is the exclusive privilege of the gardener and farm market shopper. The domain of excess is rarely the lot of country people, so we'll take this one when we get it. From winter, I always look back on a season of bountiful garden tomatoes and never regret having eaten a single one. At what point did we realize we were headed for a family tomato harvest of 20% of a ton? We had a clue when they began to occupy every horizontal surface in our kitchen. By mid-August, tomatoes covered the countertops end to end from the front edge to the backsplash. No place to set down a dirty dish, forget it, and no place to wash it either. The sink stayed full of red orbs bobbing in their wash water. The stovetop stayed covered with baking sheets of halved tomatoes, waiting for their turn in the oven. The cutting board stayed full. The knives kept slicing. August is all about the tomatoes every year. That's nothing new. For a serious gardener, the end of summer is when you walk into the kitchen and see red. We roast them in a slow oven, especially the sweet orange jaune flamme, which are just the right size to slice in half, sprinkle with salt and thyme, and bake for several hours until they resemble cow flops. The recipe says shoes, if you prefer. Their slow-roasted caramelized flavor is great in pizzas and panini, so we freeze hundreds of them in plastic bags. We also slice and slide them into the drawers of the food dryer, which runs 24/7. Sun-dried sounds classy, but Virginia's sun can't compete with our southern humidity. A low-voltage dryer renders an identical product. We make sauce in huge quantity, packed and processed in canning jars. By season's end, our pantry shelves are lined with quarts of whole tomatoes, tomato juice, spaghetti sauce, chutney, several kinds of salsa, and our favorite sweet-sour sauce based on our tomatoes, onions, and apples. August brings on a surplus of nearly every vegetable we grow, along with the soft summer fruits. Squash are the vegetable rabbits in terms of reproductive excess, but right behind them are the green beans, which in high season must be picked every day. They're best when young, slender, and super fresh, sautéed and served with a dash of balsamic vinegar, but they don't stay young and slender for long. We've found or invented a fair number of disappearing bean recipes. Best is a pureed bright green dip or spread that's a huge crowd-pleaser until you announce that it's green bean pâté. It keeps and freezes well, but needs a more cunning title. Our best effort so far is frijole guacamole, or holy moly for short. We process and put up almost every kind of fruit and vegetable in late summer, but somehow it's the tomatoes, with their sunny flavor and short shelf life, that demand the most attention. We wish for them at leisure and repent in haste. Rare is the August evening when I'm not slicing, canning, roasting, and drying tomatoes, often all at the same time. Tomatoes take over our life. When Lily was too young to help, she had to sit out some of the season at the kitchen table with her crayons while she watched me work. The summer she was 5, she wrote and illustrated a small book entitled Mama the Tomato Queen, which fully exhausted the red spectrum of her Crayola box. Some moment of every summer finds me all out of canning jars. So I go to town and stand in line at the hardware store carrying one or two boxes of canning jars and lids, renewing my membership in a secret society. Elderly women, and some men, too, will smile their approval or ask outright, "What are you canning?" These folks must see me as an anomaly of my generation, an earnest holdout, while the younger clientele see me as a primordial nerdhead, if they even notice. I suppose I'm both, if I even notice. But canning doesn't deserve its reputation as an archaic enterprise murderous to women's freedom and sanity. It's straightforward, and for tomato and fruit products, doesn't require much special equipment. Botulism, the famously deadly bacterium that grows in airless, sealed containers and thus can spoil canned goods, can't grow in a low pH environment. That means acidic tomatoes, grapes, and tree fruits can safely be canned in a simple boiling water bath. All other vegetables must be processed in a pressure canner that exposes them to higher than boiling temperatures. It takes at least 240 degrees Fahrenheit to kill botulism spores. The USDA advises that pH 4.6 is the botulism-safe divide between these two methods. Since 1990, test kitchens have found that some low-acid tomato varieties sit right on the fence, so tomato canning instructions published years ago may not be safe. Modern recipes advise adding lemon juice or citric acid to water bath canned tomatoes. Botulism is one of the most potent neurotoxins on our planet, and not a visitor you want to mess with. Acidity is the key to safety, so all kinds of pickles preserved in vinegar are fair game. In various parts of the world, pickling is a preservation method of choice for everything from asparagus to zucchini chutney. I have an Indian recipe for cinnamon-spiced pickled peaches. But our Appalachian standard for the non-cucumber pickle is the dilly bean, essentially dill pickles made of green beans. This year, when I was canning them on a July Saturday, Lily and a friend came indoors from playing and marched into the kitchen holding their noses, wanting to know why the whole house smelled like cider vinegar. I pointed my spoon at the cauldron bubbling on the stove and explained I was making pickles. I do wonder what my kids' friends go home to tell their parents about us. This one dubiously surveyed the kitchen, me in my apron, the steaming kettle, the mountain of beans I was trimming to fit into the jars, the corner where my witch's broom might lurk. "I didn't know you could make pickles from beans," she countered. I assured her you could make almost anything into pickles. She came back an hour later when I was cleaning up and my finished jars were cooling on the counter, their mix of green, purple, and yellow beans standing inside like little soldiers in an integrated army. She held her eyes very close to one of the jars and announced, "Nope, they didn't turn into pickles." Every year I think about buying a pressure canner and learning to use it so I could can our beans as beans, but I still haven't. Squash, beans, peas, okra, corn, and basil pesto are easy enough to steam blanch and put into the freezer in meal-sized bags. But since tomato products represent about half the bulk of our stored garden produce, I'd rather have them on the shelf than using up electricity to stay frozen. We would also have to buy a bigger freezer. And besides, all those gorgeous red-filled jars lining the pantry shelf in September make me happy. They look like early Valentines, and they are for a working mom. I rely on their convenience. I'm not the world's only mother, I'm sure, who frequently plans dinner in the half hour between work and dinner time. Thawing takes time. If I think ahead, I can dump bags of frozen or dried vegetables into the crock pot with a frozen block of our chicken or turkey stock and have a great soup by evening. But if I didn't think ahead, a jar of spaghetti sauce, a box of pasta, and a grate of cheese will save us. So will a pint of sweet and sour sauce baked over chicken breasts and a bowl of rice. I think of my canning as fast food, paid for in time up front. That price isn't the drudgery that many people think. In high season, I give over a few Saturdays to canning with family or friends. A steamy canning kitchen full of women discussing our stuff is not so different from your average book group, except that we end up with jars of future meals. Canning is not just for farmers and gardeners, either. Putting up summer produce is a useful option for anyone who can buy local produce from markets as a way to get these vegetables into a year-round diet. It is also a kindness to the farmers who will have to support their families in December on whatever they sell in August. They can't put their unsold tomatoes in the bank. Buying them now in quantity improves the odds of these farmers returning with more next summer. If canning seems like too much of a stretch, there are other ways to save vegetables purchased in season, in bulk. 20 pounds of tomatoes will cook down into a pot of tomato sauce that fits into 5 one-quart freezer boxes, good for one family meal each. Be warned, the fragrance of your kitchen will cause innocent bystanders to want to marry you. Tomatoes can even be frozen whole, individually on trays set in the freezer. Once they've hardened, you can dump them together into large bags. They'll knock against each other, sounding like croquet balls, and later withdraw a few at a time for winter soups and stews. Having gone nowhere in the interim, they will still be local in February. In some supermarket chains in Virginia, North Carolina, and Tennessee, shoppers can find seasonal organic vegetables in packages labeled Appalachian Harvest. The letters of the brand name arch over a sunny, stylized portrait of plowed fields, a clear blue stream, and the assurance, healthy food, healthy farms, close to home. Labels can lie, I am perfectly aware. Plenty of corporations use logo trickery to imply their confined meat or poultry are grown on green pastures, or that their tomatoes are hand-picked by happy landowners instead of immigrants earning 1 cent per pound. But the Appalachian Harvest vegetables really do come from healthy farms, I happen to know, because they're close to my home. Brand recognition in mainstream supermarkets is an exciting development for farmers here in a region that has struggled with chronic environmental problems, double-digit unemployment, and a steady drain of our community's young people from the farming economy. But getting some of Appalachia's harvest into those packages has not been simple. Every cellophane-wrapped, organically barcoded packet of organic produce contains a world of work and specific promises to the consumer. To back them up, farmers need special training, organic certification, reliable markets, and a packaging plant. A model nonprofit called Appalachian Sustainable Development provides all of these in support of profitable, ecologically sound farming enterprises in a 10-county region of Virginia and Tennessee. In 2005, 10 years after the program began, participating family farms collectively sold $236,000 worth of organic produce to regional retailers and supermarkets, which those markets, in turn, sold to consumers for nearly $250,000. The Appalachian Harvest Packing House lies in a mountain valley near the Virginia-Tennessee border that's every bit as gorgeous as the storybook farm on the product label. In its first year, the resourceful group used a converted wing of an old tobacco barn for its headquarters, using a donated walk-in cooler to hold produce until it could be graded and trucked out to stores. Now the packing plant occupies the whole barn space, complete with truck bays, commercial coolers, and conveyor belts to help wash and grade the produce. Tomatoes are the cash cow of this enterprise, but they are also its prima donnas, losing their flavor in standard refrigeration, but quick to spoil in the sultry heat. So the newest major addition at the packing house is a 100-by-14-foot tomato room where the temperature is held at 56 degrees. Participating farmers bring vegetables here by the truckload, in special boxes that have never been used for conventional produce. Likewise, the packing facility's equipment is used for organic produce only. Most of the growers have just an acre or two of organic vegetables, among other crops grown conventionally. Those who stick with the program may expand their acreage of organic vegetables, but rarely to more than five, since they're extremely labor-intensive. After planting, weeding, and keeping the crop pest-free all season without chemicals, the final step of picking often begins before dawn. Some farmers have to travel an hour or more to the packing house. In high season, they may make three or more trips a week. The largest grower of the group, with 15 acres in production, last year delivered 200 boxes of peppers and 400 of tomatoes in a single day. 23 crops are now sold under the Appalachian Harvest label, including melons, cucumbers, eggplants, squash, peas, lettuces, and many varieties of tomatoes and peppers. The packing house manager labels each box as it arrives, so the grower's identity will follow the vegetables through washing, grading, and packaging all the way to their point of wholesale purchase. Farmers are paid after the supermarket issues its check. Appalachian Harvest takes a 25% commission, revenue that helps pay for organic training, packing expenses, and organic certification. Cooperating farmers can sell their produce under the umbrella of a group certification, saving them hundreds of dollars in fees and complex bookkeeping. But they still would need individual certification to sell anywhere other than through the Appalachian Harvest label, such as a farmer's market. The project's sales have increased dramatically, gaining a few more committed growers each year, even though farmers are notoriously cautious. Many are still on the fence at this point, watching their neighbors to see whether this enormous commitment to new methods will be salvation or disaster. The term high-value crop is relative to a dirt-cheap commodity grain like corn. In season, even the highest quality organic tomatoes will bring the farmer no more than 25 cents per pound. The lower end for conventional is 18 cents. But that can translate into a cautious living. Participants find the project compelling for many reasons. After learning to grow vegetables organically, many families have been motivated to make their entire farms organic, including hay fields. The Appalachian Harvest Collective pays a full-time marketer named Robin, who spends much of her life on the phone, in her vehicle, or pounding the grocery store pavements, arranging every sale with the supermarkets, one vegetable and one week at a time. As a farmer herself, she knows the stakes. Also on the payroll here are the manager and summer workers who transform truckloads of field-picked vegetables into the clam-shelled or cellophane-wrapped items that ultimately reach the supermarket after produce has been washed and sorted for size and ripeness. On a midsummer day in the packing house, vegetables roll through the processing line in a quantity that makes the work in my own kitchen look small indeed. Tomatoes bounce down a sorting conveyor, several bushels per minute, dropping through different sized holes in a vibrating belt. Workers on both sides of the line collect them, check for flaws and ripeness, and package the tomatoes as quickly as their hands can move, finally pressing on the certified organic sticker. Watching the operation, I kept thinking of people I know who can hardly even stand to hear that word because of how organic is personified for them. One friend confessed to me, "I'm always afraid I'm going to get the Mr. Natural lecture. You know, from the slow-moving person with ugly hair, doing back and leg stretches while they talk to you." I laughed because, earnest though I am about food, I know this guy too. Dreadlocked, Birkenstocked, standing at the checkout line with his bottle of Intestinal Joy brand wheatgrass juice, edging closer to peer in my cart, reeking faintly of garlic and a keenness to save me from some food karma error. For the record, this is what Appalachian Harvest organics look like at the source. Red Wing work boots, barbershop haircuts, Levi's with a little mud on the cuffs. Men and women who probably go to church on Sunday but keep their religion to themselves as they bring a day's work to this packing house inside a former tobacco barn. If sanctimony is an additive in their product, it gets added elsewhere. The tomato room offered a 56-degree respite from the July swelter, but it was all business in there, too, full boxes piled on pallets in columns nearly reaching the ceiling. The stacks on one end of the room were waiting to be processed, while at the other they waited to be trucked out to nearby groceries. Just enough space remained in the center for workers to maneuver, carting out pallets for grading, sorting, and then slapping one of those tedious stickers on every one of the thousands of individual tomatoes that pass through here each day, along with every pepper, cabbage, cucumber, and melon. That's how the cashier ultimately knows which produce is organic. Supermarkets only accept properly packaged, coated, and labeled produce that conforms to certain standards of color, size, and shape. Melons can have no stem attached. Cucumbers must be no less than 6 inches long, no more than 8. Crooked eggplants need not apply. Every crop yields a significant proportion of perfectly edible but small or oddly shaped vegetables that are trash by market standards. It takes as much work to grow a crooked vegetable as a straight one, and the nutritional properties are identical. Workers at the packing house were as distressed as the farmers to see boxes of these rejects piling up into mountains of wasted food. Poverty and hunger are not abstractions in our part of the world. Throwing away good food makes no sense. With the help of several church and social justice groups, Appalachian Harvest arranged to deliver factory second vegetables all summer to low-income families. Fresh organic produce entered some of their diets for the first time. I grew up among farmers. In my school system, we were all born to our rank, as inescapably as Hindus, the castes being only two, farm and town. Though my father worked in town, we did not live there, and so by the numinous but unyielding rules of high school, I was farmer. It might seem astonishing that a rural-urban distinction like this could be made in a county that boasted, in its entirety, exactly two stoplights, one hardware store, no beer joints, the county was dry, and fewer residents than an average Caribbean cruise ship. After I went away to school, I remained in more or less constant marvel over the fact that my so-called small liberal arts college, with an enrollment of about 2,000, was 25% larger than my hometown. And yet, even in a community as rural as that, we still had our self-identified bourgeoisie categorically distinguished from our rustics. We of the latter tribe could be identified by our shoes, sometimes muddy if we had to cover rough country to get to the school bus, our clothes, less frequently updated, or just the bare fact of a rural free delivery mailing address. I spent my childhood in awe of the storybook addresses of some of my classmates, like 14 Locust Street. In retrospect, I'm unsure of how fact-based the distinction really was. Most of us farm kids were well-scrubbed and occasionally even stylish. Nevertheless, the line of apartheid was unimpeachably drawn. Little socializing across this line was allowed except during special events forced on us by adults, such as the French Club dinner. And mixed caste dating was unthinkable, except to the tragic romantics. Why should this have been? How did the leafy, sidewalked blocks behind the newspaper office confer